Chapter 27. Nothing so hard, but search will find it out. He'd felt the diamonds explode. For some time, that was the only thought in his mind. Felt it. One instant, briefer than a heartbeat, and a pulse of light and heat in his hand, and then the throb of something going through him, surrounding him, and then... Not then, he thought muzzily. Wasn't any then. Wasn't any now. Now there is, though. He opened his eyes to find that there was a now. He was lying on stones and heather, and there was a cow breathing... No, not a cow. He made to rise and managed to turn his head half an inch. It was a man, sitting huddled on the ground, taking huge, irregular, gasping sobs of breath. Who? Oh, he said aloud, or almost. It's you. The words came out in a mangle that hurt his throat, and he coughed. That hurt too. You okay? He asked hoarsely.
No.
It came out in a grunt, filled with pain. And alarm got Roger up onto hands and knees, head spinning. He did a bit of gasping himself, but crawled as fast as he could toward Buck. William Buckley was curled over, arms crossed, gripping his left upper arm with his right hand. His face was pale and slicked with sweat, lips pressed so tight together that a ring of white showed round his mouth.
Hurt?
Roger lifted a hand, not sure where or whether to prod. He couldn't see any blood.
My chest, Buck wheezed. Arm.
Oh, Jesus, Roger said, the last remnants of muzziness stripped away by a blast of adrenaline.
Are you having a bloody heart attack?
What? Buck grimaced, then something seemed to ease a little. He gulped air.
How would I know? It's... never mind. Lie down, will you?
Roger looked wildly round, though even as he did, he realised the sheer pointlessness of doing so. The area near Craig na Doon was wild and unpopulated in his own time, let alone this one. And even should someone appear out of the stones and heather, the chances of whoever it was being a doctor were remote. He took Buck by the shoulders and eased him gently down, then bent and put his ear to the man's chest, feeling like an idiot.
"Do you hear anything?"
Buck asked anxiously.
"Not with you talking, no. Shut up."
He thought he could make out a heartbeat of some sort, but had no idea whether there was anything wrong with it. He stayed bent a moment longer, if only to compose himself. "Always act as if you know what you're doing, even if you don't." He'd been given that piece of advice by a number of people, from performers he'd shared a stage with to academic advisers. And, much more recently, by both of his in-laws. He put a hand on Buck's chest and looked into the man's face. He was still sweating and plainly scared, but there was a little more colour in his cheeks. His lips weren't blue. That seemed a good sign.
Just keep breathing, he advised his ancestor. Slow, aye.
He tried to follow that bit of advice himself. His own heart was hammering, and sweat was running down his back in spite of a cold wind that whined past his ears.
We did it, aye?
Buck's chest was moving more slowly under his hand. He turned his head to look round.
It's different, isn't it? Yes.
In spite of the current situation and the overwhelming worry for Jem, Roger felt a surge of jubilation and relief. It was different. From here he could see the road below. Now no more than an overgrown drover's trace rather than a grey asphalt ribbon. The trees and bushes, they were different too. There were pines, the big Caledonian pines that looked like giant stalks of broccoli. They had made it. He grinned at Buck.
We made it. Don't die on me now, you bugger. do my best. Buck was gruff, but maybe starting to look better.
What happens if you die out of your time? Do you just disappear like you never were?
Maybe explode into bits. I don't know, and I don't want to find out. Not while I'm standing next to you, at least.
Roger got his feet under him and fought down a wave of dizziness. His own heart was still beating hard enough that he felt it in the back of his head. He breathed as deep as he could and stood up.
I'll get you some water. Stay there, eh?
Roger had brought a small empty canteen, though he'd worried about what might happen to the metal in transit. Evidently, whatever it was that vaporized gemstones wasn't bothered about tin, though. The canteen was intact, and so was the small knife and the silver pocket flask of brandy. Buck was sitting up by the time Roger came back from the nearest burn with water, and after mopping his face with the water and drinking half the brandy, he declared himself recovered. Roger wasn't all that sure. The look of the man was a little off-colour still, but he was much too anxious about Jem to suggest waiting any longer. They'd talked about it a bit on the drive to Craignadun, agreeing on a basic strategy at least to start. If Cameron and Jem had made it through without mishap, and Roger's heart misgave him at that thought, recalling Gillis Duncan's careful collection of news reports involving people found near stone circles, most of them dead, they had to be on foot. And while Jem was a sturdy little boy, and capable of walking a good distance, he doubted they could make much more than 10 miles in a day over rough country. The only road was the drover's track that led near the base of the hill. So one of them would take the direction that would intersect with one of General Wade's good roads that led to Inverness. The other would follow the track west toward the pass that led to Lallybroch, and beyond it, Cranesmuir.
"I think Inverness is the most likely," Roger repeated, probably for the 6th time. "It's the gold he wants, and he knows that's in America. He can't be meaning to walk from the Highlands to Edinburgh to find a ship, not with winter breathing down his neck."
"He won't find a ship anywhere in the winter," Buck objected. "No captain would cross the Atlantic in November."
"Do you think he knows that?"
Roger asked.
"He's an amateur archaeologist, not a historian. And most folk in the 20th century have trouble thinking anything was ever different in the past. Save the funny clothes and no indoor plumbing. The notion that the weather could stop them going anywhere they'd a mind to. He may well think ships run all the time on a regular timetable."
"Mm-hmm. Well, maybe he means to hole up in Inverness with the lad. Maybe find work and wait till the spring. Do you want to take Inverness, then?"
Buck lifted his chin in the direction of the invisible town.
"No."
Roger shook his head and began patting his pockets, checking his supplies.
"Jem knows this place."
He nodded toward the stones above them.
"I brought him here more than once to make sure he never came upon it unawares. That means he knows, approximately at least, how to get home, to Lallybroch, I mean, from here. If he got away from Cameron, and God, I hope he did, he'd run for home."
He didn't trouble saying that even if Jem wasn't there, Brianna's relatives were, her cousins and her aunt. He'd not met them, but they knew from Jamie's letters who he was. If Jem wasn't there, and Lord, how he hoped he was, they'd help him search. As to how much he might try to tell them, that could wait.
"Right, then."
Buck buttoned his coat and settled the knitted comforter round his neck against the wind.
"3 days, maybe, to Inverness, and time to search the town. 2 or 3 back. I'll meet you here in 6 days' time. If you're not here, I follow on to Lallybroch."
Roger nodded.
"And if I've not found them, but I've heard some word of them, I'll leave a message at Lallybroch. If..."
He hesitated, but it had to be said.
if you find your wife and things fall out.
Buck's lips tightened.
"If already fallen," he said. "But I, if. I'll still come back."
"Aye, right."
Roger hunched his shoulders, anxious to go and awkward with it. Buck was already turning away, but suddenly about-faced and gripped Roger's hand hard.
"We'll find him," Buck said,
and looked into Roger's eyes, with those bright moss eyes that were the same as his.
"Good luck."
He gave Roger's hand one sharp, hard shake, and then was off, arms outstretched for balance as he picked his way down through the rocks and gorse. He didn't look back. Chapter 28. Warmer. Colder.
"Can you tell when Jem's at school?"
"Yes. Goes on the bus."
Mandy bounced a little on her booster seat, leaning to peer out the window. She was wearing the Halloween mask Bree had helped her make, this being a mouse princess, a mouse face drawn with crayons on a paper plate, with holes pierced for eyes and at either side for pink yarn ties, pink pipe cleaners glued on for whiskers, and a precarious small crown made with cardboard, more glue, and most of a bottle of gold glitter. Scots celebrated salmon with hollowed-out turnips with candles in them, but Brianna had wanted a slightly more festive tradition for her half-American children. The whole seat sparkled as though the car had been sprinkled with pixie dust. She smiled, despite her worry.
"I meant, if you played warmer, colder with Jem, could you do it if he wasn't answering you out loud? Would you know if he was closer or farther away?"
Mandy kicked the back of the seat in meditative fashion.
"Maybe."
"Can you try?"
They were headed toward Inverness. That was where Jem was supposed to be, spending the night with Rob Cameron's nephew.
"Okay,"
Mandy said agreeably. She hadn't asked where Rob Cameron was. Brianna spared a thought as to the fate of her prisoner. She really would shoot him through the ankles, elbows, knees, or anything else necessary to find out where Jem was. But if there were quieter ways of interrogation, it would be better all round. It wouldn't be good for Jem and Mandy to have their mother sent to prison for life, particularly if Roger... She choked that thought off and stepped harder on the gas.
"Colder,"
Mandy announced, so suddenly that Brianna nearly stalled the car.
"What?
Do you mean we're getting farther away from where Jemmy is?"
"Huh?"
Brianna took a deep breath and made a U-turn, narrowly avoiding an oncoming panel truck, which hooted at them in annoyance. "Right," she said, gripping the wheel with sweaty hands. "We'll go the other way." The door wasn't locked. Jem opened it, heart pounding in relief. And then it pounded harder as he realized the lights weren't on in the turbine chamber either. There was some light. The little windows up at the top of the huge space, up where the engineer's room was. There was light coming from there. Just enough so he could see the monsters in the huge room.
"They're just machines,"
he muttered, pressing his back hard against the wall beside the open door.
"Just machines, just machines, just machines."
He knew the names of them, the giant pulley hoists that ran overhead with the big hooks dangling, and the turbines. Mam had told him. But he'd been up there then, where the light was. And it had been daylight. The floor under his feet vibrated, and he could feel the knobs on his backbone knocking against the wall as it shook from the weight of the water rushing through the dam under him.
"Tons of water," Mummy said.
"Tons and tons and tons of black, dark water all around him, under him. If the wall or the floor broke it..."
"Shut up, baby,"
he said fiercely to himself, and rubbed his hand hard over his face and wiped it on his jeans.
"You've got to move. Go."
There were stairs. There had to be stairs. And they were somewhere in here,
among the big black humps of the turbines that poked up. They stood higher than the big stones on the hill where Mr. Cameron had taken him. That thought calmed him down some. He was lots more scared of the stones. Even with the deep roaring noise the turbines made, that was making his bones twitch. But it didn't really get inside his bones. The only thing that kept him from going right back into the tunnel and hoping for someone to find him in the morning was the thing in there. He didn't want to be anywhere near that. He couldn't hear his heart anymore. It was too noisy in the turbine chamber to hear anything. He was sure he couldn't hear himself think, but the stairs had to be near the windows, and he wobbled that way, keeping as far as he could from the huge black double hump sticking up through the floor. It was only when he finally found the door, yanked it open, and fell into the lighted staircase that it occurred to him to wonder whether Mr. Cameron was maybe up there, waiting for him. Chapter 29 Return to Lallybroch. Roger hauled his way laboriously towards the summit of the mountain pass, muttering under his breath, as he had been doing for the last several miles. If you had seen this road before it was made, you would lift up your hands and bless General Wade. The Irish General Wade had spent 12 years building barracks, bridges, and roads all over Scotland. And if that bit of admiring verse was not, in fact, carved into a stone on one of the General's roads, it ought to have been, Roger thought. He had picked up one of the General's roads near Craignadun, and it had carried him as swiftly as he could walk to within a few miles of Lallybroch. These last few miles, though, had not had the benefit of Wade's attention. A rocky trail, pitted with small mud bogs and thickly overgrown with heather and gorse, led up through the steep pass that overlooked and protected Lallybroch. The lower slopes were forested with beeches, alders, and stout Caledonian pines, but up this high there was neither shade nor shelter, and a strong, cold wind battered him as he climbed. Could Jem have come this far by himself if he'd escaped? Roger and Buck had cast round in the vicinity of Craignadun, hoping that perhaps Cameron had stopped to rest after the strain of the passage. But there had been no sign, not so much as the print of a size 4 trainer in a muddy patch of ground. Roger had come on them by himself as fast as he could, pausing to knock at the door of any croft he came to. There weren't many along this way, but he'd made good time. His heart was pounding, and not only from the exertion of the climb. Cameron had maybe a 2-day lead at the most. If Jem hadn't gotten away and run for home, though, Cameron wouldn't come to Lallybroch, surely. But where would he go? Follow the good road, left now 10 miles behind, and head west? Maybe into the Mackenzies' territory? But why?
Jem!
He shouted now and then as he went. Though moors and mountains were empty, save for the rustling of rabbits and stoats, and silent, but for the calling of ravens, and the occasional shriek of a seagull winging high overhead, evidence of the distant sea.
Jem!
He called, as though he could compel an answer by sheer need, and in that need imagined sometimes that he heard a faint cry in response. But when he stopped to listen, it was the wind. Only the wind, whining in his ears, numbing him. He could walk within 10 feet of Jem and never see him, and he knew that. His heart rose in spite of his anxiety when he came to the top of the pass and saw Lallybroch below him, its white-harled buildings glowing in the fading light. Everything lay peaceful before him, late cabbages and turnips in orderly rows within the kale-yard walls, safe from grazing sheep. There was a small flock in the far meadow already bedding for the night, like so many woolly eggs in a nest of green grass, like a kid's Easter basket. The thought caught at his throat, with memories of the horrible cellophane grass that got everywhere. Mandy, with her face and everything else within 6 feet of her, smeared with chocolate,
Jem, carefully writing Dad on a hard-boiled egg with a white crayon, then frowning over the array of dye cups, trying to decide whether blue or purple was more dad-like.
Lord, let him be here,
he muttered under his breath, and hurried down the rutted trail, half-sliding on loose rocks. The dooryard was tidy, the big yellow rose briar trimmed back for the winter, and the step swept clean. He had the sudden notion that if he was simply to open the door and walk in, he would find himself in his own lobby, Mandy's tiny red galoshes flung helter-skelter under the hall tree where Brianna's disreputable duffel coat hung, crusty with dried mud and smelling of its wearer, soap and musk, and the faint smell of her motherhood. Sour milk, fresh bread, and peanut butter.
Bloody hell, he muttered. Be weeping on the step next thing.
He hammered at the door, and a huge dog came galloping round the corner of the house, baying like the bloody hound of the Baskervilles. It slid to a stop in front of him, but went on barking, weaving its huge head to and fro like a snake, ears cocked in case he might make a false move that would let it devour him with a clear conscience. He wasn't risking any moves. He'd plastered himself against the door when the dog appeared, and now shouted, "Help! Come call your beast!" He heard footsteps within, and an instant later the door opened, nearly decanting him into the hall.
"Had your wish, dog?"
a tall, dark man said in a tolerant tone.
"Come then, sir, and dinna be minding him. He wouldn't eat you. He's had his dinner." "I'm pleased to hear it, sir, and thank you kindly."
Roger pulled off his hat and followed the man into the shadows of the hall. It was his own familiar hall, the slates of the floor just the same, though not nearly as worn, the dark wood panelling shining with beeswax and polishing. There was a hall tree in the corner, though, of course, different to his. This one was a sturdy affair of wrought iron, and a good thing, too, as it was supporting a massive burden of jackets, shawls, cloaks, and hats, which would have crumpled a flimsier piece of furniture. He smiled at it, nonetheless, and then stopped dead, feeling as though he'd been punched in the chest. The wood panelling behind the hall tree shone serene, unblemished. No sign of the sabre slashes left by frustrated redcoat soldiers searching for the outlawed laird of Lallybroch after Culloden. Those slashes had been carefully preserved for centuries, were still there, darkened by age but still distinct. When he had owned, would own, he corrected mechanically, this place. "We keep it so for the children," Bree had quoted her Uncle Ian as saying. "We tell them, this is what the English are." He had no time to deal with the shock. The dark man had shut the door with a firm Gaelic adjuration to the dog, and now turned to him, smiling.
"Welcome, sir. You'll sup wi' us. The lass has it nearly ready." "Aye, I will, and thanks to you."
Roger bowed slightly, groping for his 18th century manners.
My name is Roger Mackenzie, of Kyle of Lacalche," he added, for no respectable man would omit to note his origins, and Lacalche was far enough away that the chances of this man, who was he? He hadn't the bearing of a servant, knowing its inhabitants in any detail was remote.
He'd hoped that the immediate response would be,
"Mackenzie, why, you must be the father of wee Jem."
It wasn't, though. The man returned his bow and offered his hand.
"Brian Fraser of Lallybroch, your servant, sir."
Roger felt absolutely nothing for a moment. There was a faint clicking that reminded him of the noise a car's starter makes when the battery is dead, and for a disoriented moment he assumed it was being made by his brain. Then his eyes focused on the dog, which, prevented from eating him, had come into the house and was walking down the passage, its toenails clicking on the parquet floor.
"Oh, so that's what left those scratches on the kitchen door,"
he thought, dazed, as the beast reared up and heaved its weight at the swinging door at the end of the passage, then shot through as it opened.
Are you quite well, sir?
Brian Fraser was looking at him, thick black brows drawn down in concern. He reached out a hand.
Come into my study and sit. I'll maybe fetch ye a dram.
Thank you,
Roger said abruptly. He thought his knees might give way at any second, but he managed to follow the Master of Lullibroch into the speaker word room, the Laird's office and study. His own study.
The shelves were the same, and behind his host's head was the same row of farm ledgers that he'd often thumbed through,
conjuring up from their faded entries the phantom life of an earlier Lullibroch. Now the ledgers were new, and Roger felt himself the phantom. He didn't like the feeling at all. Brian Fraser handed him a small, thick, flat-bottomed glass half full of spirit. Whiskey, and very decent whiskey, too. The smell of it began to bring him out of his shock, and the warm burn of it down his gullet loosened the tightness in his throat. How was he to ask what he so desperately needed to know? When? He glanced over the desk, but there was no half-finished letter conveniently dated, no planting almanac that he might glance casually through. None of the books on the shelf were of help. The only one he recognized was Defoe's The Life and Strange Surprising Adventures of Robinson Crusoe of York, Mariner, and that had been published in 1719. He knew he must be later than that. The house itself hadn't yet been built in 1719. He forced down the rising tide of panic. It didn't matter. It didn't matter if it wasn't the time he'd expected. Not if Jem was here. And he must be. He must be.
I'm sorry to disturb your family, sir,
he said, clearing his throat as he set down the glass.
But the fact is, I've lost my son and am in search of him. Lost your son?
Exclaimed Fraser, eyes widening in surprise.
Bride be with you, sir. How did that come about?
Just as well to tell the truth where he could, he thought. And after all, what else could he say?
He was kidnapped 2 days ago and carried away. He's no but 9 years old. I have some reason to think the man who took him comes from this area. Have you by chance seen a tall man, lean and dark, travelling with a young red-haired lad about so tall?
He put the edge of his hand against his own arm, about 3 inches above the elbow. Jem was tall for his age, and even taller for this age. But then, Brian Fraser was a tall man himself, and his son... A fresh shock went through Roger with the thought. Was Jamie here, in the house? And if he was, how old might he be? How old had he been when Brian Fraser
Fraser was shaking his head, his face troubled.
I have not, sir. What's the name of the man who's taken your lad? Robert Cameron, he's called. I dinna ken his people,
he added, falling naturally into Fraser's stronger accent.
Cameron?
Fraser murmured, tapping his fingers on the desk as he searched his memory. The motion flipped something in Roger's memory. It was the ghost of one of Jamie's characteristic gestures when thinking. But Jamie, with his frozen finger, did it with the fingers flat, where his father's came down in a smooth ripple. He picked up the glass again and took another sip, glancing as casually as he might at Fraser's face, searching for resemblance. It was there, but subtle, mostly in the cock of the head, the set of the shoulders, and the eyes. The face was quite different, square in the jaw, broader of brow, and Brian Fraser's eyes were a dark hazel, not blue. But the slanted shape of them, the wide mouth, that was Jamie.
There's nae many Camerons nearer than Loch Arbour.
Fraser was shaking his head.
And I've heard nothing of a wanderer in the district.
He gave Roger a direct look, not accusing, but definitely questioningly.
Why is it you think the man came this way?
He was seen, Roger blurted.
near Craignadun.
That startled Fraser.
Craignadun, he repeated, leaning back a little, his eyes gone wary. And where might ye have come from yourself, sir?
From Inverness, Roger replied promptly. I followed him from there.
Close enough. He was trying hard not to recall that he'd left on his quest to find Cameron and Jem from the very spot in which he was now sitting.
A friend, a kinsman, came with me. I sent him towards Crane's Muir to search.
The news that he apparently wasn't a solitary nutter seemed to reassure Fraser, who pushed back from the desk and stood up, glancing at the window, where a big rose briar curved up, gaunt and black against the fading sky.
Well, bide for a bit, sir, and ye will. It's late in the day, and you'll make no great distance before dark falls. Sup with us, and we'll gie ye a bed for the night. Mayhap your friend will catch ye up with good news, or one of my tenants may have seen something. I'll send round in the morning to ask.
Roger's legs were quivering with the urge to leap up, rush out, do something. But Fraser was right. It would be pointless and dangerous to blunder round the Highland Mountains in the dark, losing his way, perhaps be caught in a killing storm this time of year. He could hear the wind picking up, the rosebriar beat at the glass of the window. It was going to rain soon.
And is Jem out in it? Thank you, sir, he said. It's most kind of you.
Fraser patted him on the shoulder, went out into the hallway and called, Janet, Janet,
we've a guest for supper.
Janet.
He'd risen to his feet without thinking and came out of the office as the kitchen door swung open and a small, slender shape was momentarily silhouetted against the glow of the kitchen, rubbing her hands on her apron.
My daughter Janet, sir,
Fraser said, drawing his daughter into the fading light. He smiled fondly at her.
This is Mr. Roger Mackenzie, Jenny. He's lost his wee lad somewhere.
He has? The girl paused halfway through a curtsy and her eyes went wide.
What's happened, sir?
Roger explained again briefly about Rob Cameron and Craignadun, but all the time was consumed by the desire to ask the young woman how old she was.
15? 17? 21?
She was remarkably beautiful, with clear white skin that bloomed from the heat of cooking, soft curly black hair tied back from her face, and a trim figure that he tried hard not to stare at. But what was most disturbing was that despite her obvious femininity, she bore a startling resemblance to Jamie Fraser.
She might be his daughter, he thought,
and then brought himself up short, realizing afresh and remembering, with a stab of the heart that nearly dropped him to his knees, who Jamie Fraser's daughter really was.
Oh, God, Bree. Oh, Jesus, help me. Will I ever see her again?
He realized that he'd fallen silent and was staring at Janet Fraser with his mouth open. Apparently, she was used to this sort of response from men, though. She gave him a demure, slant-eyed smile, said that supper would be on the table in a few moments, and maybe Dar should show Mr. Mackenzie the way to the necessary. Then she was walking back down the hallway, the big door swung to behind her, and he found he could breathe again. The supper was plain but plentiful and well-cooked, and Roger found that food restored him amazingly. No wonder. He couldn't remember when he'd last eaten. They ate in the kitchen, with a pair of housemaids called Annie and Senga, and a man of all work named Tom MacTaggart sharing the table with the family. All of them were interested in Roger, and while giving him great sympathy in the matter of his missing son, were even more interested in where he might come from and what news he might bear. Here he was at something of a loss, as he had no firm notion what year it was. Brian died, God, will die, when Jamie was 19, and if Jamie was born in May of 1721, or was it 1722, and he was 2 years younger than Jenny, and thus had no idea what might have been happening in the world of late, but he delayed a bit, explaining his antecedents in some detail. That was good manners, for one thing, and for another, his birthplace in Kyle of Lochalsh was far enough away from Lullibroch that the Frasers were unlikely to have met any of his people. Then, at last, he had a bit of luck. When MacTaggart told about taking off his shoe to shake out a stone, then seeing one of the pigs wriggle under the fence and head for the kale yard at a trot. He rushed after the pig, of course, and succeeded in catching it, but had dragged it back to the pen, only to find that the other pig had likewise wriggled out and was peacefully eating his shoe.
"This was all she left," he said, pulling half a shredded leather sole out of his pocket
and waving it at them reproachfully.
"And a rare struggle I had to pull it from her jaws."
"Why did you bother?" Jenny asked, wrinkling her nose at the dank object. "Dinna trouble yourself, Taggy. We'll slaughter the pigs next week, and you can have a bit of a hide to make yourself a new pair of shoon."
"And I suppose I'm to go barefoot till then, am I?"
MacTaggart asked, disgruntled.
"There's frost on the ground in the morn, aye? I could take a chill and be dead of the pleurisy before yon pig's eaten its last bucket of slops, let alone being tanned."
Brian laughed and lifted his chin toward Jenny.
"Did your brother no leave a pair of his outgrown shoon behind when he left for Paris?" "I mind me he did, and if you havena given them to the poor, might be as Taggy could manage wi' 'em for a bit."
Paris. Roger's mind worked furiously, calculating. Jamie had spent not quite 2 years in Paris at the university, and had come back... when? When he was 18, he thought. Jamie would have been, will be, 18 in May of 1739. So it was now 1737, 1738, or 1739. The narrowing of uncertainty calmed him a little, and he managed to put his mind to thinking of historical events that had occurred in that gap that he might offer as current news in conversation. Absurdly, the first thing that came to mind was that the bottle opener had been invented in 1738. The second was that there had been an enormous earthquake in Bombay in 1737. His audience was initially more interested by the bottle opener, which he was obliged to describe in detail, inventing wildly as he had no notion what the thing actually looked like. Though there were sympathetic murmurs regarding the residents of Bombay, and a brief prayer for the souls of those crushed under falling houses and the like. "But where is Bombay?" asked the younger of the housemaids, wrinkling her brow and looking from one face to another. "India," said Jenny promptly, and pushed back her chair. "Senga, fetch the Carnachan, aye? I'll show you where India is." She vanished through the swinging door, and the bustle of removing dishes left Roger with a few moments' breathing space. He was beginning to feel a little easier, getting his bearings, though still agonized with worry for Jem. He did spare a moment's thought for William Buckley, and how Buck might take the news of the date of their arrival.
1730-something. Jesus, Buck himself hadn't even been born yet. But after all, what difference did that make? He asked himself. He hadn't been born yet either, and had lived quite happily in a time prior to his birth before.
Could their proximity to the beginning of Buck's life have something to do with it, though? He did know, or thought he knew, that you couldn't go back to a time during your own lifetime. Trying to exist physically at the same time as yourself just wasn't on. It had just about killed him once. Maybe they'd got too close to Buck's original lifeline, and Buck had somehow recoiled, taking Roger with him. Before he could explore the implications of that unsettling thought, Jenny returned, carrying a large, thin book. This proved to be a hand-coloured atlas with maps. Surprisingly accurate maps in many cases, and descriptions of the nations of the world. "My brother sent it to me from Paris," Jenny told him proudly, opening the book to a double-page spread of the continent of India, where the starred circle indicating Bombay was surrounded by small drawings of palm trees, elephants, and something that upon close scrutiny turned out to be a tea plant.
He's at the university there.
Really? Roger smiled, being sure to look impressed. He was, the more so at realization of the effort and expense involved in going from this remote mountain wilderness to Paris.
How long has he been there?
Oh, almost 2 years now, Brian answered.
He put out a hand and touched the page gently.
We do miss the lad cruelly, but he writes often, and he sends us books.
He'll be back soon,
Jenny said, though with an air of conviction that seemed somewhat forced.
He said he'd come back.
Brian smiled, though this too was a little forced.
Aye, I'm sure, I hope so, Aeneon. But you ken he may have found opportunities that keep him abroad for a time.
Opportunities? You mean that Demaralat woman?
Jenny asked, a distinct edge in her voice.
I dinna like the way he writes about her, not one bit.
He could do worse for a wife, lass.
Brian lifted one shoulder.
She's from a good family.
Jenny made a very complicated sound in her throat, indicating sufficient respect for her father as to prevent her expressing a fuller opinion of that woman, while still making that opinion plain. Her father laughed.
Your brother is no a complete fool, he assured her. I doubt he'd marry a simpleton or
He'd obviously thought better of saying whore. His lips had begun to shape the word, but couldn't think of a substitute in time.
He would, Jenny snapped.
He'd walk straight into a cob's web, with his eyes wide open, if the cob had a pretty face and a round ass.
Janet!
Her father tried to look shocked, but failed utterly. MacTaggart guffawed openly, and Annie and Senga giggled behind their hands. Jenny glowered at them, but then drew herself up with dignity and addressed herself to their guest.
"So then, Mr. Mackenzie, is your own wife living, I hope? And is she your Wayne's mother?"
"Is she?"
He felt the question like a blow in the chest, but then remembered when he was. The odds of a woman surviving childbirth were no more than even in many places.
"Yes, yes, she's in Inverness with our daughter. Mandy, oh, my sweet baby."
Mandy, Bree, Jem. All at once the enormity of it struck him. He'd managed so far to ignore it by concentrating on the need to find Jem. But now a cold wind whistled through the holes in his heart left by hurtling odds. The odds were that he would never see any of them again, and they would never know what had happened to him.
"Oh, sir,"
Jenny whispered it, leaning forward to lay a hand on his arm, her eyes wide with horror at what she'd provoked.
"Oh, sir, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to."
"It's all right,"
he managed, forcing the words through his mangled larynx in a croak.
"I'm..."
He waved a hand in blind apology and stumbled out. He went straight out through the mudroom at the back of the house and found himself in the night outside. There was a narrow crack of sullen light just at the tops of the mountains where the cloud had not quite settled. But the yard about him was deep in shadow, and the wind touched his face with the scent of cold rain. He was shaking, but not from chill, and sat down abruptly on the big stone by the path where they pulled the children's wellies off when it was muddy. He put his elbows on his knees and his face in his hands, overcome for a moment. Not only for his own situation, but for those in the house. Jamie Fraser was coming home soon, and soon after there would come the afternoon when red-coated soldiers marched into the yard at Lallybroch, finding Janet and the servants alone. And the events would be set in train that would end with the death of Brian Fraser, struck down by an apoplexy while watching his only son flogged, he thought, to death.
Jamie.
Roger shivered, seeing in mind not his indomitable father-in-law, but the light-hearted young man who, among the distractions of Paris, still thought to send books to his sister.
who...
It had begun to rain, with a quiet thoroughness that slicked his face in seconds. At least no one would know if he wept in despair. I can't stop it, he thought. I can't tell them what's coming. A huge shape loomed out of the darkness, startling him, and the dog leaned heavily against him, nearly pushing him off the stone he sat on. A large, hairy nose was thrust sympathetically into his ear, woofling and wetter than the rain.
Jesus, dog, he said, half laughing in spite of everything. God.
He put his arms round the big, smelly creature and rested his forehead against its massive neck, feeling inchoate comfort. He thought of nothing for a little and was inexpressibly relieved. Little by little, though, coherent thought came back. It maybe wasn't true that things, the past, couldn't be changed. Not the big things, maybe, not kings and battles, but maybe, just maybe the small ones could. If he couldn't come right out and tell the Frasers of Lallybroch what doom was to come upon them, perhaps there was something he could say, some warning that might forestall. And if he did? If they listened? Would that good man in the house die of his apoplexy anyway? Some weakness in his brain giving way as he came in from the barn one day? But that would leave his son and daughter safe. And then what? Would Jamie stay in Paris and marry the flirtatious Frenchwoman? Would he come home peaceably to live at Lallybroch and mind his estate and his sister? Either way, he wouldn't be riding near Craig na Doon in 5 or 6 years, pursued by English soldiers, wounded, and needing the assistance of a random time traveller who had just stepped out of the stones. And if he didn't meet Claire Randall... Bree, he thought. Oh, Christ. Bree. There was a sound behind him, the door of the house opening, and the beam of a lantern fell onto the path nearby.
Mr. Mackenzie, Brian Fraser called into the night. Are you all right, man?
God, he whispered, clutching the dog. Show me what to do.
Chapter 30. Lights. Action. Sirens. The door at the top of the staircase was locked. Jem pounded on it with his fists, kicked it with his feet and shouted. He could feel it back down there behind him in the dark, and the feel of it crawled up his back as if it were coming to get him, and the thought of that scared him so bad that he shrieked like a banshee and threw himself hard against the door over and over and... The door flew open, and he fell flat onto a dirty lino floor, all footmarks and cigarette butts.
What the devil? Who are you, laddie, and what in God's name were you doing in there?
A big hand grabbed him by the arm and pulled him up. He was out of breath from yelling and almost blubbering from relief, and it took a minute to remember who he was.
Jem,
he swallowed, blinking in the light, and wiped his face on his sleeve.
Jem Mackenzie, my mam's...
He went blank, suddenly unable to remember what Mam's first name was.
She works here sometimes.
I know your Mam. No mistaking that here, laddie.
The man who'd pulled him up was a security guard. The patch on his shirt sleeve said so. He tilted his head to one side and the other, looking Jem over, light flashing off his bald head, off his glasses. The light was coming from those long tube lights in the ceiling, Dar said, were fluorescent. They buzzed, and reminded him of the thing in the tunnel, and he turned round fast and shoved the door shut with a bang.
There's someone chasing you, lad.
The guard reached a hand toward the doorknob, and Jem put his back hard against the door.
No.
He could feel it back there, behind the door, waiting. The guard was frowning at him.
I just... It's really dark down there.
You were down in the dark? Whoever did you come to be there? And where's your mother?
I don't know.
Jem started being scared again, really scared, because Mr. Cameron had shut him up in the tunnel so he could go somewhere, and he might have gone to Lallybroch.
Mr. Cameron put me in there, he blurted. He was supposed to take me to spend the night with Bobby,
but instead he took me to Craignadunt, and then he took me to his house and locked me in a room overnight, and then the next morning he brought me here and shut me up in the tunnel.
Cameron? What, Rob Cameron?
The guard crouched down so he could frown right into Jem's face.
Why?
I don't know.
Don't ever tell anyone, Dar had said.
Jem swallowed hard. Even if he wanted to tell, he didn't know how to start.
He could say Mr. Cameron took him up the hill at Craignadune to the stones and pushed him into one. But he couldn't tell what had happened then, not any more than he could tell Mr. MacLeod, that's what it said on his badge, Jock MacLeod, what the shiny thing in the tunnel was.
Mr. MacLeod made a thinking noise in his throat, shook his head, and stood up.
Well, I'd best be calling your parents to come and fetch you home, eh? They can see if they maybe want to speak to the police.
Please, Jem whispered, feeling his knees turn to water at the thought of Mam and Da coming to get him. Yes, please.
Mr. MacLeod took him along to a little office where the phone was, gave him a warm can of Coke, and told him to sit down just there and say his parents' telephone number. He sipped the drink and felt lots better right away, watching Mr. MacLeod's thick finger whirl the telephone dial. A pause, and then he could hear the ringing on the other end.
Beep, 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 beep.
It was warm in the office, but he was starting to feel cold around his face and hands. Nobody was answering the phone.
Maybe they're asleep, he said, stifling a Coke burp.
Mr. MacLeod gave him a sideways look and shook his head, pushed down the receiver, and dialed the number again, making Jem say the numbers one at a time.
Beep, 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 beep.
He was concentrating so hard on willing somebody to pick up the phone that he didn't notice anything until Mr. MacLeod suddenly turned his head toward the door, looking surprised.
What?
The guard said. And then there was a blur and a thunking noise, like when Cousin Ian shot a deer with an arrow. And Mr. MacLeod made an awful noise and fell right out of his chair onto the floor, and the chair shot away and fell over with a crash. Jem didn't remember standing up, but he was pressed against the filing cabinet, squeezing the can so hard that the bubbly Coke blurped out and foamed over his fingers.
You come with me, boy,
said the man who'd hit Mr. MacLeod. He was holding what Jem thought must be a cosh, though he'd never seen one. He couldn't move, even if he'd wanted to. The man made an impatient noise, stepped over Mr. MacLeod like he was a bag of rubbish, and grabbed Jem by the hand. Out of sheer terror, Jem bit him hard. The man yelped and let go, and Jem threw the can of Coke right at his face, and when the man ducked, he tore past him and out of the office and down the long hallway, running for his life. It was getting late. They passed fewer and fewer cars on the road, and Mandy's head began to nod. The Mouse Princess mask had ridden up on top of her head, its pipe cleaner whiskers poking up like antennae. Seeing this in the rearview mirror, Brianna had a sudden vision of Mandy as a tiny radar station scanning the bleak countryside for Jem's small, pulsing signal. Could she? She shook her head, not to dispel the notion, but to keep her mind from slipping all the way out of reality. The adrenaline of her earlier rage and terror had all drained away. Her hands shook a little on the steering wheel, and the darkness around them seemed vast, a yawning void that would swallow them in an instant if she stopped driving, if the feeble beam of the headlights ceased.
Warm, Mandy murmured sleepily.
What, baby?
She'd heard, but was too hypnotized by the effort of keeping her eyes on the road to take it in consciously.
Warm, ah!
Mandy struggled upright, cross. The yarn ties of her mask were stuck in her hair, and she made a high-pitched, cranky noise as she yanked at them. Brianna pulled carefully onto the verge, set the handbrake, and reaching back, began to disentangle the mask.
You mean we're going toward Jem?
She asked, careful to keep her voice from trembling.
Uh-huh. Free of the nuisance, Mandy yawned hugely and flung out a hand toward the window. She put her head down on her arms and whined sleepily. Bree swallowed, closed her eyes, then opened them, looking carefully in the direction Mandy had pointed. There was no road. But there was, and with a trickle of ice water down her spine, she saw the small brown sign that said, Service Road, no public access, North of Scotland Hydroelectric Board.
Loch Erchdy Dam. The tunnel.
Damn, said Brianna, and stomped the gas, forgetting the handbrake. The car jumped and stalled, and Mandy sat bolt upright, eyes glazed and wide as a sun-stunned owl's.
Is we home yet?
Jem pelted down the hallway and threw himself at the swinging door at the end so hard that he skidded all the way across the landing on the other side and fell down the stairs beyond, bumping and banging and ending up in a dazed heap at the bottom. He heard the footsteps coming fast toward the door above, and with a small terrified squeak, scrambled on all fours round the second landing and launched himself headfirst down the next flight, tobogganing on his stomach for a few stairs, then tipping arse over tea kettle and somersaulting down the rest. He was crying with terror, gulping air and trying not to make a noise, stumbling to his feet, and everything hurt, everything. But the door. He had to get outside. He staggered through the half-dark lobby, the only light shining through the glass window where the receptionist usually sat. The man was coming. He could hear him cursing at the bottom of the stairs. The main door had a chain looped through the bars. Swiping tears on his sleeve, he ran back into the reception, looking wildly round. Emergency exit. There it was. The red sign over the door at the far end of another small corridor. The man burst into the lobby and saw him. Come back here, you little bugger. He looked round wildly, grabbed the first thing he saw, which was a rolling chair, and pushed it as hard as he could into the lobby. The man cursed and jumped aside. And Jem ran for the door and flung himself against it, bursting into the night with a scream of sirens and the flash of blinding lights.
What's that, Mummy? Mummy, I scared.
And you think I'm not?
Bree said under her breath, heart in her mouth.
It's okay, baby, she said aloud, and pressed her foot to the floor. We're just going to get Jem.
The car slewed to a stop on the gravel, and she leapt out, but dithered for a moment, needing urgently to rush toward the building, where sirens and lights were going off over an open door at the side, but unable to leave Mandy alone in the car. She could hear the rush of water down the spillway.
Come with me, sweetheart, she said, hastily undoing the seatbelt. That's right, here. Let me carry you.
Even as she spoke, she was looking here, there, from the lights into the darkness, every nerve she had screaming that her son was here. He was here. He had to be. Rushing water. Her mind filled with horror, thinking of Jem falling into the spillway. Or Jem in the service tunnel. God, why hadn't she gone there first? Of course Rob Cameron would have put him there. He had the keys. He... But the lights... The sirens. She'd almost made it at a dead run, impeded only slightly by 30 pounds of toddler, when she saw a big man at the edge of the drive thrashing through the bushes with a stick or something, cursing a blue streak.
What do you think you're doing? She bellowed.
Mandy, alarmed anew, let out a screech like a scalded baboon, and the man jumped, whirling to face them, stick raised.
"'What the bleeding hell are you doing here?' he said, so taken aback that he spoke almost normally. "'You're supposed to be—'
Bree had peeled Mandy off. Setting her daughter down beside her, she prepared to take the man apart with her bare hands, if necessary. Evidently this intent showed, because the man dropped the stick and abruptly vanished into the darkness. Then flashing lights washed over the drive, and she realized that it wasn't her own aspect that had frightened him. Mandy was clinging to her leg, too frightened even to wail any more. Bree picked her up, patting her gently,
and turned to face the two police officers who were advancing cautiously toward her, hands on their batons. She felt wobbly-legged and dreamlike, things fading in and out of focus with the strobing lights. The rush of tons of falling water filled her ears.
"Mandy," she said into her daughter's warm, curly hair, her own voice almost drowned out by the sirens. "Can you feel Jem? Please tell me you can feel him."
"Here I am, Mummy," said a small voice behind her.
Convinced she was hallucinating, she lifted a restraining hand toward the police officers and pivoted slowly round. Jem was standing on the drive 6 feet away, dripping wet, plastered with dead leaves, and swaying like a drunk. Then she was sitting splay-legged on the gravel, a child clutched in each arm, trying hard not to shake so they wouldn't notice. She didn't start to sob, though, until Jemmy lifted a tear-stained face from her shoulder and said,
"Where's Daddy?"
Chapter 31. The Shine of a Rocking Horse's Eyes. Fraser didn't ask, but poured them each a dram of whiskey, warm-smelling and smoke-tinged. There was something comfortable in drinking whiskey in company, no matter how bad the whiskey, or the company for that matter. This particular bottle was something special, and Roger was grateful, both to the bottle and its giver, for the sense of comfort that rose from the glass, beckoning him, a genie from the bottle. "Slange," he said, lifting the glass, and saw Fraser glance at him in sudden interest. Lord, what had he said? Slange was one of the words that had a distinct pronunciation, depending on where you came from. Men from Harris and Lewis said Slanya, while far north it was more like Slange. He'd used the form he'd grown up with in Inverness. Was it strikingly wrong for where he'd said he'd come from? He didn't want Fraser to think him a liar.
"What is it you do for yourself, a compagnie?"
Fraser asked, having taken a sip, closing his eyes in momentary respect to the drink, then opening them to regard Roger with a kind curiosity, tinged perhaps with a little wariness lest his visitor be unhinged.
"I'm accustomed to know a man's work at once by his dress and manner. Not that you find many folk truly unusual up here."
He smiled a bit at that.
"And drovers, tinkers and gypsies dinna take much effort to descry. Clearly you're none of those."
"I have a bit of land," Roger replied.
It was an expected question. He was ready with an answer, but found himself longing to say more. To tell the truth, so far as he himself understood it.
"I've left my wife with the running of things while I came to search for our lad. Beyond that..."
He lifted one shoulder briefly.
"I was trained as a minister."
"Oh, aye."
Fraser leaned back, surveying him with interest.
"I could see you're an educated man. I was thinking maybe a schoolmaster or a clerk, perhaps a lawyer."
"I've been both schoolmaster and clerk," Roger said, smiling. "Haven't quite risen, or fallen maybe, to the practice of law yet."
"And a good thing, too,"
Fraser sipped, half smiling. Roger shrugged.
"Law's a corrupt power, but one acceptable to men by reason of having arisen from men. It's a way of getting on with things, is the best you can see for it."
"And not a mean thing to see for it either," Fraser agreed. "The law is a necessary evil. We cannot be doing without